Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show, online at edexcellence.net. Now join me in welcoming my co-host, a man whose day of reckoning has finally arrived, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing,
buddy? I'm well. How are you doing, Rick?
I'm doing well. It's a big week for you.
It is a big week. It is my birthday week. And
how old are you
going to
be?
21.
You look about 21.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm going to be celebrating and see if I can get to 21 shots tonight. What do you think? Think I can make it?
21 headshots for your Facebook page?
I like that.
You've got boyish good looks.
Well, that's nice of you to say, but the receding hairline would say otherwise. But that's beside the point, because the other big thing that happened this week was, of course, that President Obama addressed Congress in his non-State of the Union address. That looked a lot like a State of the Union address. So what did you think about this? Sounds like he's going to take some of your money away in terms of tax increases.
Yeah, you know, he's so darn likable. He keeps saying things about responsibility, even when there's no evidence of responsibility or restraint or self-discipline anywhere in his package. So he talks about how all of us, even him, are going to have to give up things that one would really like to do. But then he gives laundry lists. And it sounds like the only things that we're giving up are we're raising taxes on folks making over $250, and we're stripping some funding out of the military budget. And I'm not exactly sure where this shared sacrifice otherwise shows up in his schemes.
No, I mean, I same thing here. I mean, I liked his talk about how we are in this mess, you know, because we've all spent beyond our means, because we bought houses we couldn't afford, all of that. I like that a lot. But then you get to the education section and you say, okay, I'm ready for some tough talk and some tough choices, and the day of reckoning is finally here. And he didn't really say much about that. He talked about more investments in early childhood. He certainly talked about reform and charter schools and teachers and all the buzzwords. But he never said, hey, you know, it's because we've reduced class sizes dramatically in recent years that we're now spending way more money in our education system and not getting anything in
return. And indeed, I mean, the signal he sends, right? I mean, I love the messaging about, look, parents have to take responsibility for their kids.
Right.
I mean, he hit that hard. I mean, that's a terrific point. But that's the only time it shows up where he's saying to anybody that there's not a free ride.
Right.
Everything else is we're going to borrow more money from kids so that we can ladle it out to protect today's jobs. I'm not sure how any of that adds up to responsibility.
No, and I mean, I don't think he asked the NEA to give up anything to share in this shared sacrifice, unless you consider a sacrifice that some of their members might get paid more under his merit paper.
And I mean, Nancy Pelosi sure seemed to be having a great time, and there didn't seem to be whole lot of evidence that she was particularly concerned that she wasn't going to get to fund some pet projects. So
tough. All right, well, we've got much more to talk about today. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear from Amber's Research Minute. We're going to rate that reform. All this on your Education Gadfly Show. So Ben, get us started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Budget shortfalls are pushing class sizes northward, including in New York City. In a recent Times article, University of Washington professor Dan Goldhaber, a loyal Gadfly Show listener, said that the obsession with class size stemmed from a desire for, quote, something that people can grasp easily. You walk into a class and see exactly how many kids there are, end quote. Is this analysis about right? Or is this expansion of class size, quote, disheartening and inexcusable, end quote, as Randy Weingarten says?
I go with Dan here.
You always have had a man crush on Dan, haven't
Dan
you?
Dan is a good-looking man.
And quite smart, and he's right. You do walk into a class, and it is quite easy to know how many kids there are.
Yeah, and unless any of them are, like, hidden in the closets or stuff, but we tend to frown upon that as classroom discipline and pedagogy nowadays.
You used to hide in the closets, didn't you?
I hid in the closet whenever possible, especially for my fourth-grade teacher. Oof, she would just give me that eye, and I'd be like, ah, go into the closet.
All right. So as I indicated earlier, I think this is a good thing that class sizes are rising, because we've got no evidence that smaller class sizes make much of a difference. And actually having larger class sizes mean we need fewer teachers, which means we might be able to get better teachers. Right?
I mean, and then the problem is that we're talking about all of this, you know, in the most crudely drawn fashion, of course. The reality is probably for some kids who lack strong role models in their lives, lack strong adult presence in certain subjects at certain grade levels, it probably makes a lot of sense that smaller classes make a lot of sense. And when we're talking about content-heavy classrooms for kids who are mostly learning stuff and don't need a lot of hand-holding, you can probably real easily imagine going to class sizes of 40 or 50 or more. Problem is, we talk about all of this in the broadest possible strokes. And, you know, if we're going to talk about it that way, Then I think we got too many teachers, and it makes it too hard to pay them well and too hard to train them well. So then if we're only going to talk about this in the way Randy Weingarten wants to, you know, big or small, then I'd rather have fewer better teachers.
Okay, topic number two, Ben.
Woof, that was quick. You know, let's give Dan his props a bit more, because you never see this kind of stuff in the Times.
No, I know, and I do. We wanted to feature this from Dan because, yeah, he makes... What's your point?
You know, well, your research director thinks Dan Goldhaber is top shelf.
Well, that's true. A top shelf researcher.
Top shelf. And in fact, I think Amber might, we'll have to ask her during the research minute, put to it, would she rather have an hour to talk research methods over dinner with Dan Goldhaber or her other kind of favorite piece of prime rib here, Tom Kane?
Prime rib. Okay, we'll make sure to get to that later in the research minute. Okay, Ben, by the way, will that be part of the research minute? We'll have to spend maybe... okay, Amber, you're only going to get about 45 seconds now for your, so we can talk about your prime rib. Okay, Ben, go ahead.
The New York Times editorial page thinks it's a new day for school reform thanks to the stimulus package, which, among other things, will require states to improve teacher effectiveness and end the odious practice of dumping the least qualified teachers in the neediest schools. Why does the New York Times have so much faith in the magical power of federal statute?
So, because these people don't ever learn anything from the real world. I mean, they've completely missed the lessons of NCLB or of any federal involvement. I mean, these are still people that believe, that say, well, you know, basically that Washington is good and the states are bad and, you know, Democrats are good and Republicans are bad. And they'll say, you know, if it weren't for Washington, we would never have desegregated our schools, for example. And that might be right. I mean, Washington did force states to desegregate their schools. But guess what? We know from lots of evidence that they didn't necessarily do that well. Right? And now we have No Child Left Behind, and you can say that you must have highly qualified teachers. And we're shocked that that didn't go very well. But now, because we've got a different administration and a new stimulus package saying you must redistribute teachers so that poor schools get just as good teachers as rich schools, now, because that's in a statute and we have a Obama administration, magically, this is all going to work out great.
Yeah, I mean, I got three particular huge problems here. One is the way the Times frames this totally ignores the question of teacher agency. One of the reasons teachers wind up in certain schools or in others is because they want to be there. And so long as we actually have a profession which stacks the rewards and stacks the incentives to go to certain kinds of learning environments, states trying to push teachers out against that doesn't necessarily fundamentally address the problems. So then the natural response is, let's incentivize teachers and let's try to think about this. The problem is, we know this is going to have negative effects, or there's good reason to think this will have negative effects on teacher retention, and we're not sure that these teacher skills translate as far as they're going. Third thing that presents a problem here is that this is actually the wrong way to measure whether teachers are good or not. This is a paper credential, which even most of its advocates concede is a pretty lousy read on which to measure teachers. Big problem here is that we're going to spend a lot of money redistributing teachers of uncertain value across states. We're going to be smearing that cream cheese differently rather than thinking about how do we get more good cream cheese into that vat. And I think that's the wrong direction here.
See, we're not going to be spreading the cream cheese anywhere, Rick. I don't actually think we're going to redistribute teachers.
We've got billions of dollars we're going to use to reward states to smear teachers around a little differently.
I just don't think teachers are going to get smeared, is what I'm saying. No, look, I think that in the end of the day, the only way you fix this problem is by completely equalizing funding across the board. Because a lot of this is driven by salary differentials, and you can't fix that unless you have completely equalized funding.
But that's not even really the problem, because if you look at Newark and Trenton, they're actually paying more per pupil than some of these adjacent suburban districts, which have a higher percentage of, under NCLB by definition, highly qualified teachers. So it's not even just a money deal.
Right.
It's that how districts are spending this money, and it's the environments in which teachers want to teach. And if we try to strip mine teachers out of relatively professional, you know, teaching environments to try to move them into districts and schools where they're not at, only a New York Times editorial writer would be confident that we're not going to drive some good teachers out of the profession.
Mm-hmm. Okay, topic number three.
Officials in Oregon are contemplating cutting the length of the school year as the way to close budget gaps. Is this a reasonable solution?
It's a stupid solution.
Stupid?
Stupid. Well, the kids got to be happy. I mean, right? I mean, your average kid, 5 or 4 days of school, woohoo! But... you know, the fundamental problem here is there's a lot of other ways to slice this. Mm-hmm. We could either squeeze, say, operational savings out. We could find ways, we were talking about class size earlier, since I'm much more confident that an extra 5 days of learning time matter rather than another half kid in your class. Mm-hmm. We could find ways to thin out teaching ranks and make sure that the kids are getting the same amount of education. But no, we want to protect jobs. We want to make sure that we don't actually have to ask for any givebacks from the teachers. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to reduce the amount of school.
I guess I understand that. I think it was in Portland last year. The teachers did work for, was it a week or maybe even 2 weeks without pay at the end of the school year, and they made it clear that they were not going to do that again this year. We were talking earlier, you know, that if you're going to do this, I think it's important that you not tell the kids about this plan. Okay, so they just they think that they're going till June 15th, and then say at Memorial Day, you say, hey, guess what? No more school for the rest of the year.
Right, because last
2 weeks they'll let up. Yeah.
Right, the last 2 weeks are letting up.
Yeah.
So if you're only losing kind of that deceleration time,
doesn't
matter. So
the parties, all that.
Because the other problem is that kids will just ratchet back expectations, and you're still burning. In fact, if you only had a two-week-long school year, the entire time would be spent with kids in deceleration mode.
Let's not do that.
Exactly.
Wow. Is anybody proposing to have a two-week-long school year, Rick?
Well, I get a bunch of mail from like these elementary kids about that stuff I've written about summer school over the years, and I think they would be pretty jazzed up about it.
Yeah. Interesting. I like that. Okay. Well, that's all the time we have for Part of the Gadfly, which means it is now time for Amber's Research Minute. You know, we do get listeners complaining about the fact that we have replaced the opening song in our show, no longer the checker fin medley. But nobody complains about the Research Minute medley. They really like that. And, of course, they love you, Amber. You're our star.
But, Amber, we've got a question for you.
Oh, please. Are you really going to go there?
We're really going to go there. So you're on a flight out to the Pacific Northwest. You've got one night in, you've got one night in Seattle, Washington. Do you want to sit down and talk research methods with Dan Goldhaber of the University of Washington or Tom Kane of the Gates Foundation and Harvard University?
That is a really, really tough question because I have great admiration for both of their bodies of work. Read.
Oh, the body!
Did I really need to say that? That is going to be edited out. Please tell me.
Oh, that's a keeper.
Freudian.
Being right along.
Well, no. This is like the Brad Pitt, Hugh Jackman question. You got to answer. Which your listeners want to know.
What if they're both listening, and then you know?
Rick, it's a false choice. Why can't she sit down with both of them at the same time?
That's right.
And what would the conversation be? Would it be about teachers for sure, right?
Teacher quality, absolutely. Yeah. That's what it would be about.
Dan, Tom, if you're listening. I think you guys have to buy Amber a cocktail next time.
All right, Amber. Research Minute time. What's the topic today?
All right. This week we've got the latest Brown Report out from Tom Lovelace at the Brookings Institution. It includes three studies, but I only have time to highlight one, which is the study of PISA, the international test that measures 15-year-olds' knowledge of math and science. It's going to garner the most attention, I'm sure, since NGA and other national groups are looking to the test as the holy grail for international benchmarking. Lovelace presents a scathing indictment that PISA's fascination with political ideology and student attitudes is wholly inappropriate for a test of science. For instance, PISA has numerous questions assessing self-efficacy in science, which Lovelace's calculations, unlike PISA's, show they have mostly negative relationships with student performance. In other words, the more confident kids are in their science abilities, the lower that nation's scores. American children think they know math and science. Singapore's kids don't, and they do much better than we do. But who cares? This isn't a test of confidence. It's supposed to be about math and science knowledge, not what kids think they know about science and math knowledge. So let's hope that those interested in PISA as an international benchmark remove their rose-colored glasses.
Ooh, wow.
Bringing it. Tommy Love. Bringing the heat.
Was that a minute?
That was about a minute. That was good. It might have been a little bit long, but you know what? Okay. That's okay because let's talk about Tom Lovelace being, you know, going a little bit long between his Brown Center reports.
Huh? Yeah, but he brought the heat, baby. Yeah,
he did bring the heat. Weren't these annual at one point?
Yes.
And now these are, what, occasional? I mean, am I mistaken that this is the 2008 Brown Center report?
It is the 2008, yes.
And it is February 20th.
not even 2 months into the new year. Not even 2 months.
Yeah, it was close. There's been a lot going on.
That's right.
Wow, that's tough stuff.
Yeah, it's tough stuff.
Now, you know, recently, just this week, the Think Tank Report Project out of Colorado beat up on some of the work Tom had done for you guys. That's on right. The gifted education studies.
Mm-hmm. They did. And mostly they were beating up really on myself and on Checker for supposedly taking the findings and extrapolating too far in terms of our policy recommendations. I thought we were very careful with our language to say, look, this study is not a causal study. Still, you know, here's what we might take from it. So those people, those think tank review projects, you know, they say that they're all about, you know, trying to make sure that there's rigorous work going on in think tanks. But it's strange that they only look at certain think tanks that happen to be to the center right.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. You never see them go after indeed. Jack Jennings think tank, for example, or Education Trust. Perhaps those all only publish excellent, unquestionably rigorous work all the time. All right, not to get defensive there, so sorry about that. So Tom is not a fan of PISA.
Not a fan.
What's interesting is just the other day there was an event at Common Core about 21st century skills, and Ken Kay, the director of the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, was resting a lot of his argument for these skills on PISA. He was saying, well, clearly the United States is not doing well on PISA. We do better on TIMSS than on PISA because PISA tests these 21st century skills. TIMSS does not, and Europe especially is embracing 21st century skills, and so should we. Tom, I guess, is not satisfied with that argument.
Not in the least. Yes.
Tommy Love pushing it. He's pointing out the Leaning Tower that is PISA.
I knew you'd go there. Okay. All right, Amber. So that was a cheesy comment by Rick.
Yes,
do you have a cheesy song?
I do. Well, since this study cuts like a knife into those who would hold PISA in high esteem, we have Cuts Like a Knife by Bryan Adams.
All right. Ooh, I love Bryan Adams. Boy,
me too.
I tell you. We're trying to figure out, what is he, like 60 by now?
Oof, well, somewhere 69, he was 18.
That's so. Right. So there it is. Do so the math.
Probably just about. Actually, you know, and Kobe Smulders had that great line on How I Met Your Mother. She said Bruce Springsteen was like the American Bryan Adams.
Huh, yeah, that's true. All right. You know, one more thing in this PISA thing. It's interesting. So Russ Whitehurst now is the new director of the Brown Center.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder what he thinks about these findings in light of the fact that when he was at the Institute for Educational Sciences, he oversaw the United States, involvement in PISA. Mm-hmm. I wonder if this is a broadly shared view that PISA is worth pushing over all the way. Not just leaning, but push it all the way over. Anyway, this is so disheartening, though. You know, that, I mean, if it's true that PISA can't be trusted and is all a bunch of silliness, it seems like we've really lost the war here, you know, because it's now being used by so many people around the world, and certainly in this country, as a benchmark and a standard.
Well, but that's because people around, I mean, this is the problem with people desperately seeking the new quick fix. We don't actually say, hey, what are these standards actually, what do they consist of, and what do these assessments actually measure? Somebody just says, oh, that sounds international and cool, let's run with it.
But you know what, you know who does have a standard? Stafford has a real standard that she uses to
rate
that reform. Stafford, let's hear about it.
And what happened? What attacked your neck?
What attacked my neck?
Something's on your neck. Like big, billowy.
Scarf.
It's a scarf, right? All right. Well, today's story is about school dances. So you remember in middle school how the boys stand on one side of the room and the girls stand the other, and neither are willing to venture into the great divide? And then you get to high school, and not only is there no empty space between the two, but you're picking the guys off the girls like flies on flypaper.
Poetic, yes.
Except for Mike, who was breakdancing.
I was
doing the head spin.
Well, of course.
How'd you know that? I used to do this backspin. My friend would, you know, move my legs around and...
Can I continue?
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead, Steph. That trip down memory lane. It was Bryan Adams. It got me thinking about.
Of course, those are your glory days.
I wanted
Mike.
To see you on Randy Jackson, Best American Dance Crew, busting it.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, Rick is currently wearing his sunglasses in the studio, listeners. Just in case you're wondering.
And
anyway,
parachute pants. Yeah.
One Ohio high school principal has had enough of this vertical expression of a horizontal desire, and he has proposed banning all grinding, bumping, and dirty dancing, or whatever you want to call it, by requiring all students who attend this year's winter formal to sign a contract agreeing to a no-grinding policy. It's just inappropriate, he harumphed. Unfortunately, the joke is on him, since the school has had to cancel the dance due to low ticket sales. Mm. Students thought that this new grinding contract was basically the death of fun and are boycotting.
Huh.
So I'm going to assume the goal here was to get kids to stop grinding and not to cancel the dance. So I'm going to say that making them sign an agreement promising that they won't grind is a good idea if that's your goal. So I'll give them an A for problem definition. Execution, obviously this had some unintended, albeit amusing, consequences. So maybe the school is happy that they don't have to deal with throwing a winter formal. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're out a few $1,000 on the band rental and decorations. In either case, I'm giving them an F. Let me clue you in, guys. Don't warn the kids you're going to kill their fun. If you tell them, they'll be suspended for giving into their hormones. They're going to find another party to go to. And the school should probably be on the lookout for any kids whose parents are going to be away this weekend.
You wait till they're in the door.
And then you have the chaperones pulling off each other.
This is the theme this week, is that we the less information to the kids, the better. We just surprise them at the end.
This is what they used to do, like in the old movies, like Grease and stuff, right? Yeah, the chaperones used to walk around and just pry them apart with a crowbar.
Yeah, and they, you know, they had like a ruler. It's okay, you got to have a foot in between. That's what the nuns used to do.
You have to leave space for the Holy Spirit, right?
But can you can you do this 2 years in a row, though? Right, because you play it the 1 year, but then do the girls who went as juniors with their senior boyfriends, do they then clue everybody in the second year?
Right, right. True. No, that's a good question. But I did this principal not see Footloose? I mean, this is just you can't win this battle.
Well, apparently all the parents were calling in and telling him how much they liked his idea. Mm. So all the parents were in support of it.
Well, I mean, I think potentially, right? Worst case is you cancel the formal. Parents don't earn out for $150 to give kids stuff to go rent whatever the heck it is kids need to rent. Mm-hmm. And the kids are just going to, they'll go to somebody's house and, you know, and instant message one another or Twitter. So, you know.
All right. Well, thank you, Stafford, for rating that reform. You know, speaking of texting and Twittering, you know, I thought that Stafford might report on an article that came out this week that a student was actually arrested for texting in class.
Nice.
Arrested.
Nice.
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, where what?
I'm not sure where it was, but they actually called the police.
Wisconsin, we think. Yeah.
And when the police came and asked the girl to hand him her phone, she stuck it down her pants.
She just couldn't
clearly
stop texting.
You know, yeah, she just couldn't control herself.
And finally, I will say that in Maryland, it looks like they're going to finally pass a law to make it illegal to text while driving.
That is a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think we can all agree about that. But you know what? Again, we might not want to tell the kids until the last one. All right. That's all the time we got for this week. Till next time.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, having a birthday and signing off of the Education Gadfly Show.